Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And I'm Jim Henson, and this is the Second Reading Podcast. But funny thing, so it's Thursday afternoon, about 4 o'clock. We came into the studio a little before 2, started recording the podcast, talking about whether the Democrats were going to come back, whether they weren't going to come back. We talked mostly in the podcast, Josh Blank and I, about implications, what was at play. Walked back up to my office after recording that podcast, and the Democrats had come back. So it goes. You know, you win some, you lose some when you record later in the day, I guess, or don't pay attention to what's happening the next day. We knew they was going to happen, that they were going to do a check on Friday. What you're about to hear, I think, still has a lot of decomposition of what's been going on and what the story is. But just know that we missed it by that much, as Maxwell Smart would say, and events outpaced us a little in the recording of the podcast. Give it a listen. Enjoy. If you need to scroll past some of the things where we're speculating about the will they or won't they, there's not a lot of that. We got caught by events and timing, but I hope you enjoy it anyway. And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. We're back. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Joined again today by Josh Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project. Josh, happy summer, dude.
It's great to be here. And I really do mean that.
Good. All right. Well, we'll talk about that some more. Okay, so we've been on an intermittent summer podcast schedule. I mean, a few people have even noticed.
Yeah, I've seen more people have given me guff than I would have thought, by which I mean like a few.
Right, exactly. we've been gone a bit. I mean, briefly on this absence, we agreed to teach one of the very large online Intro to U.S. and Texas courses in the fall semester here at UT, which begins on August 25th.
Okay.
You can't see Josh quivering a little bit over here.
Can you feel it?
You know, in about 10 days. So, well, you know, for vibrating and almost in harmony, maybe. We have been hard at work all summer long building this course. I keep telling people, and yes, I'm spending a lot of time working. I realize I'm not mining coal.
Yeah, right.
Or anything. But, you know, it's been a lot of work that we're spinning this online asynchronous course up. For the first time we've taught it together, first time Josh taught it, first time I've taught it in quite a while. So, you know, and we're needing, because of the format of the course, the online delivery, we're going to have about 1,000 students in the course. We need to do a lot of work ahead of time. So we're doing this part that everybody thinks about. We say, oh, you teach a course. We're writing lectures and decks and gathering material and figuring that out. But it's also, you know, a lot of construction,
right.
You know, building administrative process, course design, et cetera. So, you know, on the past summers, to be fair, we've taken off some time from the pod for R&R. I just want to say this hasn't been the case. I'm
laugh crying over
I'm just
here.
Expressing myself, I guess. And, and this is also, you know, we've gone pretty dark, been laying pretty low. That's part of the reason, if you're somebody who's been trying to get hold of us for media or other things, same applies. I'll apologize ahead of time. I think I've been able to write most people back saying, you know, sorry, just don't have time. And, you know, we also have not wanted to do hot takes. And we'll talk about that in a minute, which brings us to the dominant big story in Texas, and that is The Hunting Wives on Amazon.
Yes, The Hunting
Wives. If you haven't watched The Hunting Wives, you know, Dermot Mulroney is looking to challenge Abbott from the right. There's all kinds of things going on in the East Texas exurbs.
Right?
Not really a show to watch with the fam. If any of you are watching this, you know what I mean. It's a little bit of a hate watch. I am interested in the accumulation of Texas media representations. We've got The Hunting Wives. We've got Landman, which I think I've joked on here, or Landman, as I call it.
Landman.
But anyway.
That is really right up your alley, though. I mean, there's a
point. Well, you know, like I said, you know, the
the collection anyway, of Texas yeah. representatives.
Don't get me going on the hunting wives. You know, but it's a sign that that's kind of the thing, sort of what I've needed as we've been, the way this summer has gone is, you know, something pretty trashy. All right. Anyway. So the real dominant story of the day in Texas, which at various times over the last month or so has also been one of the top national news stories, is, of course, the mid-century redistricting effort instigated by pressure from the White House and how it's intertwined with the special session called by Governor Abbott, which began on July 21st. I think the last time we did a podcast, we were looking at the agenda, right. and that was all said, and we knew the redistricting was coming, and you know, there was talk of the walkout at the time, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you know, we could start a million different places. I think we decided jointly, you know, despite a request from one of our listeners, to probably not go back and explain the entire timeline here or try to recap. If you're listening, you're probably reading a lot. You know, in short, Governor Abbott called a special session, had this big agenda. It was set to begin on July 21st. Democrats in the House fled the state, or some number of them, and that number has fluctuated a little bit, but enough to break quorum, and they have dispersed to a few different places. Some have been moving around a little bit, you know, mostly in Chicago, but little bunches making forays into California, New York, a couple other places, I think. And so since then, it's been a matter of the Senate doing its Senate thing.
Doing its Senate thing, yeah.
Maybe. You know. Given the House some downward casts, both down and side eye.
Yeah, right across and down.
You know, can you give somebody side eye and look down at them at the same time? I guess if you turn your head, but
it hurts. Kind of hurts my skull.
But I think that's kind of what's going on. Yeah. I think it's a fair characterization. So the Senate has been marching through the special agenda items to some extent. And interestingly enough, something that had been kind of buried a little bit, and we were just talking about this in another context offline the other day. Things got pretty hot again, have gotten pretty hot again on the THC thing.
Yeah.
In fact, in part because the House doesn't do anything, nothing else. Well, you know, the House has had some committee hearings and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, in sort of in this, it's interesting in the sense that obviously everybody's sort of focused on the Democrats, they're focused on Abbott, they're focused on, you know, Trump's role in this.
Right.
And then, you know, it's sort of like, well, here comes Dan Patrick.
I
matter too. And it's like, we're going to keep doing what we're going to do and then, you know, create some cover. You know, it makes
sense.
I mean,
this is pretty, you know, shooting fish in a barrel for Lieutenant Governor. After a little kind of a rocky end of the session, you know, this kind of breaks his way a little bit to some extent, right?
I think so.
And, you know, meanwhile, the House has been meeting periodically, you know, trying to see if there's going to be a quorum.
Yeah,
and which there has not been. And this week there were what? They met on Tuesday and we
counted 95 members present.
Right. Had 95 people there, including a small handful of Democrats. And we'll come to that in a sec. But, you know, to step back, I mean, as we were talking about this, there's just a fascinating mixture of both predictability in some ways. And I think it's a little bit off message, but it's just that the things that are predictable are not that interesting, but also a huge amount of uncertainty coming from any number. I mean, there's an inherent uncertainty when you break quorum, you know, folks scatter, you know, they leave state, you're trying to figure out who's going to come back, who's not, what the, you know, and you don't know what's going on, they're gone and, you know, they're communicating selectively. But also, I mean, you were talking about the kind of intertwining of kind of the political and the legal, or the institutional and the political, or, you know, these kind of intertwined things that are making this difficult. And you were talking a lot about the state level. I think it's true in terms of the federal stuff that is at play here too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think what's interesting to watch, and part of the reason that I think, you know, we've both been resistant to, you know, make a hot take here, or even honestly to respond to some, you know, reasonable questions, is because of the fact that there's sort of two things going on. And on the one hand, there's the politics of this, which is always there. And, you know, hey, we talk about politics, no problem. Just observing it, right? And then there's this other piece of it, which is sort of the legal process that surrounds what's going on here. And I'm not even, you know, and that could mean any number of things. We could talk about the legal process surrounding mid-decade redistricting. We could talk about what, you know, the legality of, you know, what the state is of, you know, minority opportunity districts in this country, and whether this is the time that some people might challenge that kind of approach. We're talking about the legality of removing Democrats from all these things. But the thing about that is that the politics of that is instantaneous, right? So, you know, if you're the governor, you can say, I filed something with the Texas Supreme Court.
That's a good way of thinking about it,
The legal process is slow.
Not.
Right?
Exactly. Not instantaneous.
It's not instantaneous. And especially with some of the issues that we're talking about here, which honestly, you know, at 30,000 feet, and again, we've been doing a course on intro government, constitutions, we've been thinking about this.
Yeah. Lucky you all,
because you're going to get a lot. Lucky, get ready.
There's going to be a lot of bleed through.
Let me take my watch off here. But basically, you know, if you think about it, there's a lot of intergovernmental stuff going on here, a lot of questions here about, you know, if you just take a step back, you know, Does the executive branch, whether the governor or the attorney general, who are both part of the executive branch, separately elected here in Texas, does it have any role to play in removing members of the legislative branch? Pretty unlikely historically from a constitutional perspective. You know, people weren't really worried about runaway power from individual legislators or worried about kings, executive authority, that kind of stuff.
Well, or, you know, Northern Republicans.
To the
point of the Texas Constitution.
Yeah. Right. And so, you know, one, there's that piece of it. You know, there's the fact that he's now, you know, the executive branch is asking the judicial branch to step in and essentially engage in the affairs of the legislative branch. And I should point out, the Texas Constitution clearly lays out that there is a way to remove members from office, and it's through the legislative branch. The legislative branch has the power to remove its own members. And not surprisingly, if you can, quick Gov 101, separation of powers here, not surprisingly, the legislative branch does. Not surprising, the framers of these constitutions did not give power to the other branches to remove members very easily from each other, and specifically from the legislative branch.
Right. It was not, it's not accidental that there wasn't a lot of constitutional precedent cited in the governor's move on this and his filings with the court.
Now,
trying to remove Gene Wu specifically.
Right. And we'll probably come back to that.
Head of the Democratic
Caucus. Yeah, we'll probably come back to that. But like, you know, putting out a press release along with a filing with the Texas Supreme Court, which is an interesting place to do that. You know, I mean, look, it generates headlines. It generates a lot of questions about, well, can the governor remove? And the answer is, we don't know. We don't think so. But ultimately, the courts are going to decide, and that's going to be a slow process. And this gets back to that whole, well, what do we expect the courts are going to do here? And that's kind of one of, I mean, at least to my mind, that's one of the big questions of the sort of the two big questions that I have kind of in terms of understanding this. But the problem is that I think, you know, in just sort of a natural news cycle sense, we see an action that looks like it's going to have some kind of legal consequence, but you got to take a step back and say, one, maybe, maybe not. And two, even if it does actually, let's say, kickstart a legal process, that process is going to take usually at a minimum weeks.
Right.
So that's something I think, you know, just in and of itself has, at least on my side, I think for you too, is led me to be a little bit reticent to comment on the daily maneuverings here because of the fact that honestly, you know, there's a clear disjuncture between, I think, the politics as they're being couched in certain sort of legal maneuvers on the one hand,
right,
and the reality of the way that the legal process is going to play out on the other.
Well, and I think, you know, and what's interesting to me, you know, to spin off of that at both, you know, you can look at this at the state level, you can look at it at the national level, which is the way that, you know, part of the gray area here is how the players in these executive versus judicial branch kind of bumps, you know, how much is baked in, who's anticipating what? I mean, for example, when the governor did ask the Supreme Court, the Texas Supreme Court to, you know, rule on his, you know, effort to remove Gene Wu, you know, he asked like, and I'd like you to, you know, chop, chop.
Right.
I'd like you to get back to me right away. And the court was like, yeah, we'll have a hearing in a couple of weeks. And by the way, that couple of weeks is kind of after this special session that's going right now will be over.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then now we're in this, you know, to bring us up to where we are today, which is a good way of, you know, sort of updating that is. And now in the wake of that ruling, and I'm not, you know.
Right.
Sequencing is not causality.
No.
You know, and then there's a lot of moving parts, which is kind of one of the things we're inherently talking about here. But, you know, and now, you know, so now Democrats didn't show up again on Tuesday, as we were saying. And, you know, memo went out yesterday, from Speaker Burroughs following a meeting between the big three, governor, lieutenant governor, speaker of the House, which said, okay, here's the plan. You know, the House is going to, both houses are going to convene on Friday morning. I believe the House comes in at 10 tomorrow. Meaning we have to be extra careful what we're saying here now. House comes in tomorrow at 10, And if there's not a quorum, then they're going to adjourn sine die. The governor will call another session, you know, immediately after, and they will, and, you know, the House members were instructed to be ready to show up on Saturday.
Right.
Right. But that resets the clock.
Yeah.
For the Democrats, for obvious political reasons that we were talking about before we came on, but, you know, puts more pressure on the Democrats.
Well, you know, puts more pressure on the Democrat on the back end. I mean, on the front end, it's also a quick test. I mean, in the sense
it's a collective action test.
Yeah, and that's the other big question. I'll drop it out real quick and come back at some point. But, you know, ultimately, I mean, one of the other difficult questions to answer that a lot of people have been sort of throwing in our direction is, well, you know, what's the end game for Democrats, or what's the strategy? And the point I would keep saying is, like, look, the idea that you can say that the Democrats have a unified, singular strategy when you've got, you know, 50, 51, 52 right. people off in different states with really, honestly, different potential theories of the case and what a win looks like here is— Different incentive structures. And so, like, I can't say what the Democratic endgame is other than maybe to try to push off the calendar so far that, you know, this kind of falls off a cliff. But that, as we'll get to, maybe may work, may not.
Right.
But the other side is the main point here is that we don't know. And so the real question is, what does the Democratic resolve look like? You know, there's a collective action problem here. When do the costs for some people or enough people feel like it? And I think, you know, the last time we saw this, we saw that, you know, once they kind of, at least last time, it seemed like once they got through one special session where the Democrats had delayed it and they said, okay, well, now we're going to do another one. It was clear that at least some members in the coalition said, well, I fought the good fight, but they're just going to keep doing this. And now I'm coming back. Now, look, that's not saying that this is the same thing this time. But what it's saying is, I think by doing that, you're testing it.
Well,
on the Republican side.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a, you know, whether it's the, you know, uncertainty.
Yeah.
It's certainly a benefit of this decision that you get to reset the clock and look for weaknesses.
Yep.
And look, we know from the last couple of times the Democrats have done this, and, you know, this happens with a varying degrees of publicity, and there's a lag with some of this that, you know, we always find out that while they were gone, you know, there were lots of tensions between individual members, you know, to some degree, maybe between factions. But my understanding, my memory of reading and hearing this stuff offline is, you know, a lot of it is just the regular personal stuff of, you know, I was talking somebody about this morning, you know, and I'm kind of going, well, you know, they're elected officials, and they're just people.
Yeah.
You know? Well, I mean, this is a, you know, it's an inherently stressful situation. You've got the financial pressures that is sort of, that is out there and unresolved, you know, and so all of that is going on. And I would just say, just to close out that larger point there, I mean, I think the way that, you know, when you were sort of unspooling the uncertainty there, I mean, and, you know, the question about, well, what's the longer timeline here?
Right.
You know, that plays into, you know, the scenario in which, you know, at this point, and given the degree of investment and who's got leverage here, if you're a betting person, I wouldn't bet on when, but I think you have to bet that, you know, by hook or by crook, those maps will get passed at some point.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a sure thing, but that's the odds on.
So why don't you, because I agree with you, and I think I agree for a lot of the similar reasons, so why don't you lay out, you know, what the major contributing factors are to that bet?
Well, I mean, I just think, you know, you in a way, you walked right up to it before, which is we know in the past that this is always the question about a quorum break.
Right.
What is the end game?
Yeah.
I mean, the thing, you know, the quorum break does not restore the lack of leverage you have in the chamber that led you to leave to begin with.
Right.
You know, it enables more opportunities for cultivating allies. That seems to be working better this time than it ever has worked in terms of the national politics.
Right.
That's context.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I
love that. I was thinking about this, you know, people have asked oftentimes, well, you know, if Abbott just calls special session after, I mean, this is for a different context. Yeah. You know, if he calls special session after special session after special session and they don't do what he wants, you know, what's the consequence? And I said, well, the only consequence besides, you know, the agenda not being passed is that eventually the governor looks weak. And that's just to say, you know, sometimes exercising what political power you have is not necessarily a sign of strength,
right,
to your point. This is the only path. And then I think the other piece to your, you know, point that I would add to the sort of the why is that the most likely outcome is that, you know, really the end game here is not, you know, Republicans decide they don't want to redistrict.
Right.
That's just not really, that's not on the table because it's just, not. I mean, just to your point, is this is not a reflection of, you know, Democrats expressing a bunch of political power. Everybody's too
overinvested now. And Donald Trump.
But I mean, the other
this
piece
is a Trump origin redistricting. So.
And I think historically, I mean, you know, if we want to say, well, you know, look, there are times and there are certain states, Texas not really being one of them, where the courts express a certain amount of reticence about implementing new maps too close to candidate filing deadlines, too close to elections, too close to primary elections. Right. You don't want people filing to run in seats and then change the seats around. Like that's just not. It's not good. But here's the thing, too. We've also seen the courts in Texas pretty willing, in the face of new maps, to bump back those election dates.
Well, that's where I was going to go with that.
That's where I thought you were going to go. And as you recall, I mean, the most sort of famous of this recently is, of course, Ted Cruz and David Dewhurst, and that those elections getting pushed back to the point where the runoff is in, you know, the middle of July, which really, you know, is a benefit. Now, the thing is they were willing to do that. And I'll also point out, in between then and now, Texas has actually moved up its election calendar. And what that means, in my mind, you could say, well, doesn't that mean there's less time? It's like, yeah, ostensibly, but it also means there's more time to push it back.
Right. I mean, and where I was going to go with that was that, you know, was going to hit the intermediate step before the 2012 example, which is that, you know, another thing that's changed in the last few years, and certainly since 2003 – but, you know, and certainly since 2012 is that, you know, the jurisprudence and the legal recourses and remedies that Democrats are likely to use in terms of the Voting Rights Act, you know, anti-discrimination, one person, one vote, case law, et cetera, both statutory and precedents, you know, are either explicitly weaker due to things that have happened in the interim.
Yeah.
Or, you know, likely, you know, on tenuous footing because of changes of the evolution of the court in a more conservative direction that is clearly hostile to considering race in terms of elections, maps, almost, in, you know, anything at this
point.
And
I'll even add to that, on top of that.
At least race in terms of the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah. And then on top of that, in this new environment, the, you know, I don't know what you'd call it, the legal interest universe that supported Democratic efforts, you know, on these legal challenges has been attacked directly by the Trump administration in a way that, look, you know, whether, you know, they're on the back foot right now too. So the people who would normally step into this, you know, very altered and significantly less advantageous environment for Democrats, and it really is less because of the removal of preclearance, they don't exist now.
Right.
Federal government's not coming to step in, and the legal network that would normally step in is weakened right now.
Right. So you've got all of these things that make all of that, all of the judicial part of that at the federal level, you know, very shaky. And again, broken record, you know, very uncertain. And I do think that, you know, the longer this goes on, the more likely that scenario is, which is why, you know, sort of, you know, beating that dead horse. But, you know, I think the longer this goes on, the more the 2012 example becomes relevant, and that has implications for 2026, thinking about some of the lessons of 2012 in that delayed primary.
Right.
You know, for those of you who don't remember, primary was scheduled for the usual March primary, usually that time, got delayed twice, once to April and then to June. That meant the runoff didn't get held until July.
Right.
And that's when Ted Cruz beat David Dewhurst for the Senate seat. Now, again, as we should all be quick to say, you know, I wouldn't say that's why Ted Cruz won.
It helped.
But, it, you know, it didn't hurt Ted Cruz, and it probably, you know, you know, actively hurt somebody that was already pretty seriously wounded at that point in that race in David Dewhurst.
Right.
So, you know, what else? You know, we haven't talked much about – we've mentioned it, but we've not said much about the Senate. So, you know, I mean, I kind of just said, you know, the Senate is doing their Senate thing. You know, this has touched the Senate, you know, on some on some floor votes earlier this week. Nine Democrats walked out.
Yeah.
Zeffirini, it was on the maps.
Yeah.
Two Democrats stayed, which preserved quorum, which has, you know, earned them some opprobrium on from the usual corners, particularly social media. Senator Zaffarini and Hinojosa stayed, voted against it, but still gave them quorum for the vote.
Yeah.
And again, I don't think, you know, I didn't see anybody that was particularly shocked by that, but.
Well, I mean, what's interesting, I mean, I'll just, maybe this is a good jumping off point, but, you know, the sort of the way that the quorum break has resulted in this, you know, in this state of, this locked state of affairs right now, you know, this ossification of where we're at. I mean, what's interesting is that it's actually sort of freed people to just focus on politics, you know, in some way. So you're talking about, you know, you're the Senate Democrats, you know, they're all playing their political game. For Patrick, you're going to pass, you know, a hemp bill that if it were to actually like come up on the House floor would probably be knocked down a point of order because it doesn't meet the call, but you can still do it, right? Because ultimately there's no consequence at this point. Yeah. And so that kind of speaks to the fact that, you know, you've got these sort of, I mean, we're talking about like before this sort of weird thing where you've got these kind of fights going on between, I mean, like sort of public fights between Abbott and Paxton on the one hand, and not really directly, but indirectly between
these competing filings with the Supreme Court. But, you know, that was as explicit a public disagreement between Paxton and Abbott as we've seen in a bit, if not ever.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was really.
I mean, somebody, you know, I'm sure people out there might remember something else, but this is pretty high profile and,
well, I mean,
and pretty clear.
Yeah, and to me, I mean, I can only see that in the context. I mean, for me, not I can only, but I mean, I want to see that also in the context of Senator Cornyn asking the FBI to, you know, quote unquote, locate the Democrats, right? And when you think about it, it's like, you know, well, I mean, you can locate, they're on social media. There's no, like, you don't need the FBI to find them. Brad Johnson can find them, you know, like they're here.
Right.
But I mean, to make the point, it's sort of, it's it, in some ways, this goes again, like, well, what's your power look like right now? It's like, well, I have the power to ask the FBI to find the Democrats to make it seem like I'm engaged in trying to end this.
Right. And I think, you know, when we talked about the Abbott-Paxton thing, and obviously there's a Cornyn-Paxton.
Well, there's a Cornyn. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Dimension here that reflects the obvious 2026 Senate race.
Yeah. And I think what this obviously all reflects is, you know, this all reflects an effort by, you know, these major political actors to appeal to Donald Trump to say, I am doing the best I can here. And part of it is I think both Cornyn and Paxton are trying to be engaged in this in a way that puts them in a leadership spot because they're looking for that endorsement in that Senate race.
Yeah.
I mean, why Cornyn would get involved there and ask the FBI to find them? He's not asking to arrest them. They can't arrest them. There's no, they haven't broken any federal laws. So it's kind of like he's not getting the FBI to go round them up.
Right.
And if you're Paxton.
But he asked.
Yeah, but he asked. And if you're Paxton, you're basically saying, you know, yeah. I mean, and again, I have some problems. I mean, you know, we can go into it or not. But with Abbott's filing with the court and Paxton's thing, and look, and part of this is we do have a plural executive in Texas. They are both independently elected members of the executive branch with their own constituencies, their own politics. You know, this is not like, you know, and just to make clear, again, we're in the government space, sorry, but it's like, you know, the government teaching space. It's not like the president who appoints the attorney general, right?
Yeah,
and that person
right.
works for him, right? I'm just saying for the audience's sake. And so, you know, they're doing their own thing here. But also, you know, this is very clearly Paxton trying to kind of put his elbows out and say, hey, whoa. You know, I'm the one who's responsible
right.
for the law enforcement here, you know?
Yeah, and look, there's some history there. I mean, we said there's not been an open, you know, and look, Abbott is very good at maneuvering as he's going to maneuver and minimizing the open friction, particularly with, you know, the darlings of the favorites of the quote unquote grassroots groups.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of have objections to that, but, you know, Republican primary voter base, fair enough.
You're right, though. I mean, he hasn't had much – I mean, he's avoided
a
lot of friction with Paxton, and Paxton has not made it easy.
Well, and look, and he's, you know, I mean, he's had a decade of contending with a very powerful and popular lieutenant governor.
Right.
And so, you know, he's – you know, they've got some chops at this. This is not
– Right.
But this is all very elevated, right?
Right.
Which kind of brings us to, you know, I mean, I want to spend a couple minutes on – you know, another one of these moments where Texas is now intertwined with national politics, and clearly we saw some of this with the immigration and not even immigration, with the border issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
During the interregnum, the Trump interregnum during the Biden presidency, and, you know, with Greg Abbott being very nationally and getting a lot of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, acknowledgement, sometimes kudos, sometimes a negative kind of acknowledgement,
right.
The way that he was able to drive that issue in the national media and in national politics, in ways that I would argue ultimately benefited Trump, but, and as far as Abbott himself.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, even, this is a lot more complicated than that, I think, ultimately.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure, I don't know if we want to go here yet, but I'm just not sure, you know, how the politics of this play out in the medium long run, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I think like in a basic sense, I mean, just I want to acknowledge, you know, given that we both think most likely outcome is they pass the maps. I mean, you could say, look, the immediate politics is the Republicans win. They get the seats they want. Now,
that's, they get it late. It's a mess in the courts.
Yeah. You know. And I mean, oh, and, you know, I should, you know, I've been something just to throw this out there. I mean, and one of the reasons, you know, we sort of just some of the politics of this, I mean, in the national piece, you know, one of the reasons it makes sense for all these governors from other Democratic states to be like, no, come here. We'll protect you. We'll save you. It's like, because you know what? Because then they don't have to go and try to redistrict in their state in response. Like if they can, you know, they can be national heroes right now at a time when the Democratic Party has no leaders. So you have a bunch of governors saying, we'll take them. We'll take the National Democrats. Bring them here. I'm on MSNBC. Yeah. I'm talking about this stuff. But also like, you know, the idea that like New York Democrats want to redistrict. The idea that, like, in Illinois, they want to try to squeeze one more seat out of a map that they've really, you know, juiced. Like, yeah, even California, too, same thing. It's like, I mean, you know, most people don't want to do this.
Well, just like they didn't want to do it here.
Right, just like they didn't really want to do it here. And so, you know, there's just that sort of piece
of just like it, but, I mean, they didn't want to do it here either would have been the better way to phrase that.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, I mean, I think, you know, on the one hand, I think, you know, like just at least locally, not knowing what the response is going to look like and how widespread it's going to be and all that kind of stuff, if Republicans succeed here, but you think, you know, short term politically, it's probably good for them. Long term, I mean, what I'm seeing in the polling, this is what I say to people when I'm sort of looking at this and thinking about the Democratic calculation in the House and Texas Democrats is, you know, one of the really interesting things to me in the polling that we saw in June, and this is like very much, I think, a Trump effect, so it's the end of the session. You know, we've talked to you guys about this before. When we ask what's the most important problem facing the country, we normally talk about Republicans and immigration and all that stuff. And we talk about Democrats, we say, you know, without doubt, without fail, multiple times, there's like six or eight issues that we need to like combine together till we get the same number of Democrats as, you know, who basically equal the number of Republicans who focus on immigration borders. So what do I mean? Like Democrats, what's the most important problem? It's climate change. It's gun control. It's education. It's abortion, healthcare, on and on and on. But in the last set of polling we did, you know, both at the national level and the state level, you saw a big share of Democrats going and saying it's political corruption and it's leadership. Right. And to the extent that that is a Trump-driven phenomenon, which I think is very clear at this moment to say it is, and to the extent that Trump is directly and very, very publicly inserting himself into Texas politics and governance in a way that's like not careful, not quiet, like it's just saying, this is what I want, you guys do this for me.
Yet intentional.
Yeah, intentional. And bringing, you know, an Abbott, you know, really whether – you know, this is what his preference or not is getting as close as possible in these moments to him. And part of that's because he's looking around at these other people who are all saying, well, you know, I'll get closer. You know, I think that probably tipped the scale. I mean, for a lot of Democrats, think, well, what about this political moment? Like, how do you meet your voters and what they're looking for? Well, they want to see you resisting Trump. They want to see you resisting Abbott. They want to see you doing it, you know, in a public way. And they've basically, you know, again, they didn't get to pick the battle. But that's the battle that was put in front of them.
Right.
And so I think that's sort of, you know, what is probably in some ways, you know, made their resolve a little bit stronger. Because if the last time they did the quorum break and we did polling on that, it's pretty clear pretty quickly that it wasn't really breaking their way.
Yeah.
It didn't seem the public wasn't reacting positively. And there's still time. We'll see what's going on. We're going to do more polling, obviously. But it didn't seem like the initial reaction was there. And it was, and I mean, and the underlying piece of this is most of the time, most voters are not paying a bunch of attention to the legislature. They're not paying attention to a special session. The fact that a governor calls a special session doesn't mean that all of a sudden, you know, a bunch of voters are like, oh, what's going on, when barely 10% of them are following the legislature closely during the session. But insert Trump into it, insert this big national discussion.
Right.
And it's, I think it does change the calculus for Texas Democrats.
It does. And I guess there's a couple of things couple of directions to go with that. I mean, I think, you know, on that specific line of thought, one of the things I've been wanting to do for the last week and been busy trying to hit deadlines for the class is to kind of put this in the context and put some of this data on the website or on a post or something of the problems that the Democrats have had.
Right.
Right. So on one hand, you kind of emphasize the or mention the, you know, the attention to political corruption now that Trump is back as the most important issue and leadership and all that. But the other, you know, the flip side of that are these very kind of wan Democratic numbers, right?
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, Democrats' approval ratings of their own party, which really tanked after, you know, in the going into and especially after the 2024 presidential election,
right.
You know, Democratic voters are not looking at the Democratic Party and going, oh, yeah, those are our guys. They're kind of going, yeah, you know, either I disapprove or, you know, it's, yeah, they're, you know, they're all right. They're right party. But,
yeah,
you know, and so there is
or they're not Trump.
Yeah. Well, or, yeah, I mean, so there is this sense that. But the point is, that's why that number, I think, is interesting in comparison to the MIP thing. It's like, yeah, there's these negative, but, you know, in some ways, I feel like the Democratic approval numbers, you know, Democratic attitudes towards the party got bad enough in the wake of the Biden problem and the 24 election that it's weakened their ability. It's either weakened their ability or increased their need to rely on negative partisanship. And so if you are, and that's a bigger problem for Democrats in Texas that are out of power than it would be if they were in power somewhere. Now, those two things are, you know, it's endogenous, but, no, but at the same time, I mean, they have the problem that says, you know, we're looking for something. And if this is what's, I mean, I think the way you put that, you know, they didn't ask for this fight.
Yeah.
So now they're kind of trying to use this fight for that. Not bad in the short run. I have real questions about it in the long run.
Well, I mean, I think that's the way you put that I really like, and I just want to sit on for 1 second, which is, you know, I think if there's anything that we've seen in the last, you know, whatever you want to call it, decade plus, whatever it is with Trump, you know, outside of the 2018 elections, it's not clear that Democrats can simply run against Trump. I think we've sort of, you know, this has been kind of talked about a bit. This has been litigated in advance. And right now, you know, parties say, well, what do the Democrats run on? You say, well, the party's in the toilet. You know, views of the party are negative. And when you say, like, when I say that, it's like, well, what do you, like, hey, that's aggressive. It's like, well, who leads the party?
Yeah.
Like, who right now is strategizing for what the path forward is for Democrats? And even if there was a person who was doing so sensibly, is there any sense that the rest of them would follow?
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Just like, politics.
They're all, you know, a lot, not all.
They're all leading.
No, they're not all of them. But, you know, there are several people kind of going, I got a strategy, but.
Right. And everybody has their theory of the case and whatever. But honestly, and, you know, we've been talking about, like, everything is so up in the air right now, just in terms of, you know, the nature of the party coalitions and what it means to be a Republican and what conservative ideology looks like and what progressive is and blah, 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 blah. Like, it's almost, it's a bigger challenge than it even looks like.
Yeah. And you know, you can see that. I mean, it's all this very, it's kind of murky.
Yeah.
Right? In the sense of you've got, you know, you've got Gene Wu leading the caucus.
Right.
Right, but not a statewide figure.
Right.
You've got, you know, Beto O'Rourke back in play.
Right.
At least in some ways, right?
Yeah.
You know, which is, you know, not hurting his Senate, you know, that the Senate, you know, his consideration of him as a Senate candidate. You've got, but, you know, he's also now involved in this beef with Paxton over the funding and all, you know, and again, whether that goes anywhere, it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, that may just accrue benefit to him, honestly.
Yeah, right. It could be a net benefit. I mean, I think you're right in that it's put him back in play.
It's like a negative op-ed in the New York, or it's like a negative editorial in the New York Times about a Texas Republican. You're like, oh,
right.
I've been sued by Ken Paxton so many times, I can't keep count.
Yeah, I mean, so I think, you know, so there's all of that. You've got, you know, the James Tallarico boomlet going on.
Yep. Jasmine Crockett's over
and yet,
there.
And, you know, people calling up wanting to talk about Jasmine Crockett and Jasmine Crockett showing up again at the house, testifying, all this kind of stuff. So there's a lot of churn there and a lot of activity, but I think the difficulty in breaking out of that is, you know, and hopefully we'll have some polling data on that, you know, next time around, you know, as we get back in the field. But, you know, I think all of that is still just, you know, problematic. In the sense that it's unlikely for that to get better for Democrats. As these quorum breaks and these kinds of relatively complicated political fights play out over time, you know, they lose their charge, and for the participants, it becomes a slog.
Yeah. Well, you know, you were saying before, you know, they're just people. And I was like, no, they're worse than people because, and I mean, I love all our legislators, but, you know, these are people who are normally treated with a certain degree of deference and respect in their day-to-day lives. And now they're living in a hotel in Chicago with a bunch of other legislators and out of state, you know.
Well, and look, and right now.
And it's a slog. It's
and like, right now they're, yeah. And, you know, still, we're still, you know, a couple weeks into it.
Yeah.
But. you know, I mean, you know, the slog line gets steeper as the media attention declines.
Yeah.
Right. So in the first week, you know, you turn on,
right,
you know, any cable, you open a podcast, like, oh, it's a Texas state legislator.
Yeah.
Or there's a few of them on the Today Show or whatever.
Oh, I know that person.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But that, you know, particularly in this media environment, but even, you know, in the previous, I mean, you know, and to even go back to 2003, you know, by the time you started getting into the, you know, third, fourth week, I mean, people weren't paying that much attention. It's just like, yeah, they're still gone. And,
well, and to make a point.
And that's when the defection started. And that's why that goes back to this idea of going, okay, we'll just restart the clock. You guys enjoy being gone.
Well, and I'll add on to what you're saying there too. And Donald Trump floods the zone in a way that makes keeping attention on that one thing that much harder.
Yeah.
Right. So even in the partisan media the Democrats may be looking to tap, you know, they're going to be moving on other stuff because Donald Trump is going to keep them busy. And I think this is the point, just to, you know, it's like, it's not clear that, you know, for a party in the position that the Democratic Party is in, relying on antipathy towards Donald Trump is a pretty good way to guarantee about 30% of your vote. But that's not enough.
Right.
And the thing is like—
Because enthusiasm for him guarantees him about 30% of the vote.
Right. And then and then he's actually doing things that are meeting the desires of his potential voters, and ultimately he's putting Democrats on the back foot on most things. And so, you know, it's a pretty long— I mean, it's a climb, you know, and that and that's the thing that sort of is interesting to see how that's going to play out. And that's why I say, you know, how does this play out? Well, you know— I mean, going back to the politics of it, as I said, I think long run, not great for Texas Democrats right now. Having said that, you know, we'll see. I do think, you know, it is interesting how much, you know, the focus is on the rules. I mean, a mid-decade redistrict is interesting. And I mean, and the other piece that all of this has been, you know, kind of mentioning is like, and we talked about this, I think, the last time we were here, which was a long time ago, is, you know, while the Republican map, if and when passed, is likely to produce the results that it intends to produce, there's no guarantee it will continue to produce those results going forward.
Yeah, but I think we said this, you know, in which, you know, Donald Trump doesn't give, you know, two flips about.
He's not going to be running for re-election. So.
Right. I mean, he, you know, this is a, you know, short to medium term play for him. You know, I mean, along the lines of what you're talking about, I mean, two things. I mean, I want to close out with, like, you know, to some degree, what has been predictable. I mean, I think something
you
about—
You started there.
These circumstances always go, oh, you know— All the fizz, you know, or as my wife would say, the shiny objects, right? A lot of shiny objects here because of the uncertainty. But we can't leave the Democratic dilemmas. Actually, this is why I thought about this. The transition into the predictable is the last beat that we could hit, or the last, you know, another beat on the Democratic conflict. And that's the way that the Lloyd Doggett, Greg Kassar, you know, having been pitted each other, you know, in the way that the maps are drawn. So everybody listens to this, but just in case, they basically redrew the Austin area maps, which, you know, had, you know, I think in some ways kind of surprisingly in 2020, in the last redistricting, had been relatively, or at least comparatively, non-provocative with Austin. So you had an East Austin district that was good for Greg Kassar. You had Lloyd Doggett kind of reconsolidated to some degree. Yeah. In a predominantly Austin district. Now the Kassar district has been redrawn to be plus 10 or something, you know, a Republican district. Yeah. And, you know, Doggett's district remains, you know, even an even stronger Dem district because he's absorbed some of the Kassar voters and so.
Right.
So, you know, early on in this, we were, you know, and it was interesting. You and I both commented on it offline. It was like, you know, Doggett and Kassar were appearing together, which politically made all the sense in the world. Well, you know, that was then and this is now. And now, you know, Doggett has declared that he is running for that, you know, he's staying in that district and, you know, is urging his respected progressive colleague to stay in his own district, even though it's been redrawn and is now a Republican district. Congressman Kassar seems to be declining that invitation, but also saying he's going to run in Austin because he's, you know, owes it to Austin, but, you know, the rhetoric is all.
Yeah.
But that gets us into what's, you know, the things that have worked and that are predictable about this, right? That was, you know, this scenario was the intent, one of the intents of that map, right? In terms of this particular thing. And, You know, the other thing that has worked out, I think, and, you know, that we haven't really raised, or only very briefly, I think, that is also part of the game plan here on the part of the governor and the Republican leadership, the big three, is, you know, the difficulty of that the Democrats have in dealing with Republicans' control of agenda and sequencing. And we talked about that last time before it had really all started. But I mean, I think that's clearly operative in that, you know, you've got, you know, Republicans saying, again, very predictably, you know, the Democrats aren't showing up to do their job.
All we
really want to do is provide FUD relief and, you know, respond to these terrible problems and, you know, the horribleness of all that. And the Democrats are, you know, left to say, oh, no, you're putting politics because of this redistricting and you're putting it on the agenda ahead of that so that we can't, you know,
you're
and that's just the advantage is with the Republicans on that.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, you know, Democratic base voters, you know, will listen to the Democrats long enough, presumably, to understand that.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's just a loser, and that's what we're seeing.
Okay, I want to play too then. You know what else is really predictable?
Yeah.
That hypocrisy makes no difference. And just to be clear, you know, he said, you know, we were sort of talking a couple different angles of this. I'm not going to go too deep here, but it's like, you know, we're thinking about the idea of like, oh, you know, these members aren't representing their districts. They're running off. You know, so now look, we can set aside whether, you know, what we think the constitutional provisions require, blah, 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 blah. But I think, you know, you pointed this out, it's like, boy, that congressional district in Houston didn't have an election for a long time.
Right.
You know, if we're so concerned about people's representation, you know, and it's kind of like, okay, you know, I would say.
And Jake Tapper, you know, got in a pretty saucy exchange with Governor Abbott. I don't think he was using actually that. He was using the Kay Granger example.
Okay, where, yeah.
You know, if you're so worried about dereliction of duty, where were you when Kay Granger was in a institute, you know, a facility for 6 months, but was still presumably serving in Congress?
Right. And I mean, and then there's another angle, which is, you know, there's been these terms of bribery thrown around a lot. And like, look, first and foremost, you know, if somebody's been bribed, I think that a law enforcement official should take that person to court and prove it in a court of law regardless. But I'd also say, just to take a step back, and this is the whole hypocrisy thing, you know, man, there are almost no campaign finance laws in Texas. They're not none, but they're very, very lenient.
Yeah.
And when you're a governor sitting on $80 million, many million-dollar checks, when the storyline of the last election was you're taking $4.5 million from an out-of-state businessman to primary members of your own party to achieve a specific policy that he wanted and that you wanted, I just think like throwing around bribery is a little like, oh, let's just, you know, let's chill out, everybody. But also, it doesn't matter. And again, that's part of the predictability of this. Again, it's like, you know, I just say that because I know that there are people who listen to this who think, well, wait a minute, but you know, remember when this? It's like, for your ordinary person who's kind of following this from a pretty distant, that's not like part of the space.
Yeah, right. I mean, just to be clear, you know,
and I'm not saying anybody,
you're not saying no, was bribery and this isn't, or it's all bribery and it's all.
I don't.
I mean, I the way that I would take that, and I think it's a really good point, is that, you know, a lot of cash and over time in increasingly large amounts from fewer people are lubricating Texas politics.
Yeah.
Now, this is not new, as you say. It's not like Texas is known for its stringent campaign finance laws. In fact, the opposite. But I mean, I think you're right that as you start throwing around the idea of, well, you know, there's some cash changing hands here. I mean, and look, there are, you know, there are legal questions to be answered. And they, as you've said, they will be answered, albeit probably at a glacial pace.
Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, there have been, you know, we had a judge enjoin Beto O'Rourke to not spend money. And he went and had the rally anyway. And as you've said, the politics of Beto for that are kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that idea, and I think there's, and so, you know, to, you know, start to close out and go to like, again, back up to 30,000 feet from that. I mean, there's a, I think I was trying to express this earlier in the office, or we might have gotten sidetracked on the syllabus or something, but, you know, something like the syllabus. But, you know, there's a sense in which all the attention on this and the pressure and the churn that it's creating does throw up opportunities to go, oh, so that's kind of where we are right now and how these institutions are relating to each other. The back and forth between Abbott and Paxson on one hand and the court, and the Texas Supreme Court clearly kind of going, oh yeah, no, we're going to do this on our own pace, like after the special session's over there. Well, no, the special session's going to be going. So now what are you going to do?
Right.
The degree to which, the balance of power between the different branches has shifted in the state.
Yeah.
And has been in a state of flux. At the national level, this whole, at a more small beans, small beer kind of level, this ongoing thing about, how nationalized are politics in Texas? Well, right now, pretty driven by national politics and by, what Donald Trump wants.
Right.
Right. And so there's all these things that these kind of moments of crisis kind of flush out.
Right.
Because you get a break in the routine and you get people trying to press the boundaries, and that brings out where the boundaries have moved.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, that's the other thing too. And when you start pushing that stuff, one of the questions you ask yourself, and one of the things I think, we're trying to be, cognizant and cautious about is like, well, so what would be the consequence of that? It's like, if a court found that Gene Wu was being bribed and, clarified what these laws look like, what would be the implication for other Texas lawmakers, because, it does raise, to your point, it's like, if representation is so important within some sort of timely manner, what does that say about the governor's ability to just sort of delay a special election for months and months? These questions, again, does this matter in an immediate sense? Does it matter for 2026 in terms of like answering these big picture questions? No, but for people like us who are watching this long-term trajectory and seeing the way these things are shaking out, this is a really, not to overuse it, but sort of a pregnant moment, sort of thing about, I'm really waiting to see how does the judiciary respond? Because on the one hand, in a traditional sense, they would say, hey, look, this is a political question. The Constitution is very clear. Bye. But, most of these justices have been appointed by Abbott in a very predictable pattern and fashion.
And have run or will have to run in Republican primaries.
Republican primaries in which he has enough money, if he were so inclined, to swamp them. And you say, he could do that.
And remember, we saw a precedent. Not for the Supreme Court, but in the last, in the last Republican primary cycle, Ken Paxton very quietly and effectively intervened in some judicial races and had an impact.
Right, exactly.
And that is not lost on anybody. So that's another institutional piece like, this is that whole popular election of judges thing.
Right.
Is this more democratic?
So is this a separation of powers if they're all elected by the same?
What are we really getting with that? We will see. I've been sort of, my informal straw polling suggests that nobody really thinks they're going to get enough Democrats to show up tomorrow and that they will not make quorum tomorrow. Now, by the time you hear this, that may prove to be wrong. We know that, we did a count before we came up here. There were, seven Democrats that, were in the chamber on that 95 count, and interestingly, and I don't know what the exact number is, and I'm not, sure who does, but there are some number of Democrats that have not been showing up, but that we think are still in the state.
Right.
And so there is a little bit of an X factor here. I don't think it's big.
Well, I do want to point something. Let me just throw something out there, just because I know, we get to the end of this, and we're like, nothing matters. And
I wasn't saying that. I didn't.
No. And I'm saying, but I mean, there's sort of a, I think that people can kind of come away with that sort of, thing. And I think, one of the things that strikes me is I do believe, from where I sit and the sort of things I look at, if it were the case that, the FBI or the ATF or some federal law enforcement agent, let's see, were to start arresting Democrats based on civil warrants in Texas and another state to return them, that might escalate the attention to this. And similarly, I think, to your point, I think that, there are Republicans who know where their colleagues are in the state. I think there's probably a reticence to send state troopers to their home and drag them in if they can help it, especially if they're not going to make a quorum with it.
Right.
And even if they were, the idea of dragging politicians, ostensibly, and they could claim expressing their First Amendment rights to the Capitol, you know, that's a wild card. And I don't think, and I think people are kind of avoiding that.
When you go serve these civil warrants, are you going to put handcuffs on people?
Exactly.
And then, you know,
what if they're civilly disobedient? What if they drag their legs? Like, is that what we're doing? You know?
Yeah. And you know, some of these members are elderly. Exactly. You know, there's just a lot of, you know,
the optics of that are very, very bad. Right.
They're very bad, but you know, I would also say that one of the notes I had, we haven't touched on. I mean, one, you know, this is one of those 30,000, you know, where, you know, not to be overly self-serving a little bit, you know, I mean, I try to stay away from the prediction piece, although it's tempting, but like, what is this showing us, right? What can we kind of learn that we wouldn't see if this wasn't going on, or, you know, what is it pushed to the foreground anyway? And, you know, the erosion of discourse and norms that has been evident in moments of this fight have been pretty striking.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, there's no point being that coy about it. I mean, it got a lot of coverage. I mean, you know, you had Mays Middleton posting that, you know, is asking if Gene Wu was in China. And then when he got criticized for it, doubling down and making some other kind of, you know, ethnic slur of some, you know, ethnic cultural slur. And, you know, I will tell you that if you, you know, you're not spending that as much time on social media anymore, and I'm spending less, but if you go on X and look at the responses to the Middleton thing, you know, he was not, on balance, I doubt that the people that are engaging in that kind of communication strategy are getting any kind of negative feedback.
Right.
Right? If anything, they're going, well, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
That worked for me. And so, you know, that's the one thing I say is that, you know, we're seeing, you know, this whole thing about these things, moments pushing boundaries. You know, on one hand, my impulse is, you were saying that, you know, are they really going to, you know, perp walk people in? Does anybody really want that? Go, yeah, right. That's, you know, on the other hand, I, you know, all it takes is, you know, one or two people to make an impulsive decision. And, you know, you've got
constitutional rights violated out the wazoo.
Yeah, you've got a situation in which that's really tested.
Yeah.
But, you know, and but then in which we might find out it's like, oh, well, actually, yes, it counter-mobilized Democrats, but the base of Republican primary voters doesn't seem to have any problem. And if we've learned anything over this last 10 years, that the inhibitions that used to prevent appealing to, so we say, you know, the worst angels of our nature, the devils of our nature, you know, have been lowered overall. And so there's something, I mean, you know, I mean, I think I basically agree with you on that, but I'm also in the back of my mind going, but you know, if, would, how surprised I would be, it would feel shocking, but would I be utterly surprised if at some point I saw them dragging a Democratic member into the House in handcuffs? You know, not as much as I, you know, a lot less surprised than I would have been, you know, 5 years ago.
But this is where I think, you know, we need to be really careful, especially as people who study public opinion and kind of look at this at a broader level. You know, I would say I agree with you. And when you're talking about, you know, someone like Mays Middleton and the type of people who are following him on Twitter and engaging with his content, we're talking about, you know, a very, very narrow universe of people. Think about the people like sitting here listening to this, you know, we're talking about a very narrow universe of people. When we're talking about, you know, the politics that we've talked about all the time that are driving a lot of the decisions of Texas Republicans, it's about Republican primary politics, which, as you all should know, make up a tiny, tiny share of the overall electorate. And I, you know, and I think whether I talk to, you know, people who are left-leaning or right-leaning or whatever, and they kind of lament one thing or another about it, you know, I sort of like to say, I don't think that most of your neighbors want to see you jailed for your political views. I don't think that most people's neighbors are looking around thinking, you know, it'd be good if we just arrested all these fill-in-the-blank Democrats, Republicans, or whatever. You know, I've kind of pointed this out to people. You know, there's a lot of people who served in the military who, you know, may be Republican, may be Democrat. I don't think they're looking to, like, go to martial law because they, you know, honestly, probably.
Well, yeah.
I'm just saying, I'm not saying this against you. I'm just saying more generally, like, in the sense that, you know, a lot of those people chose to serve because they love the country, they love the Constitution. Again, how that manifests itself is another thing. But the idea of turning force against your neighbors and against, you know, representatives, I think, you know, yeah, it's going to turn some people on, no doubt. And maybe more than we think, and maybe more than it used to. But in general, I still believe that that's like a pretty questionable line.
Yeah, no. And
I think it's going to bring other people into the process. It changes the nature of that electorate if you do something like that. That's what I would be wondering about.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I kind of thought that after 2020.
Fair enough.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, I've gotten a little more reluctant to rule things out based on.
Yeah.
And again, I largely agree.
We're nibbling around
what the probability judgment is here, you know, both of which probably need to let below 10%. But yeah. I have questions because I do think that everything you just said is I agree with in terms of what's out there, but I also think the tendency to focus very narrowly on very few people.
Yeah.
And frankly, for people to miscalculate.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Based on heat of the moment, ego.
Yeah.
Bad advice. I have concerns about it.
Well, again, I'm not saying it's not going to happen. I just said that I think if it did, it might fundamentally change the underlying.
Yeah.
You
know, the
environment and the dynamics about it.
I think I would say to that, say that happens, there's a negative counter reaction. You lose a few moderate Republicans, you mobilize Democrats, the economy goes south. It could become a factor in the 2026 cycle.
Yeah. And you were just saying, hey, look, I thought 2020, they go, yeah. And I didn't think that the Democratic president would just disappear for a year, show up, and then be kind of incompetent.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot going on
there. You know.
As we're saying this, I think the president has essentially taken over Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it seems so. And one is trying to some other cities, other Democratic cities.
To do it for
and
others.
Again, I mean, we're doing
and,
this.
And, you know, again, he can do it. But, I mean, he'd have a hard – I shouldn't say he can't, to be consistent with myself. But, you know, there are bigger obstacles. I mean, taking over D.C. from the position, given the charter and all that is – you know, it's different. But just, you know, the fact that they're threatening is something.
Well, yeah. I mean, that really is like, what year is it? Like 1802?
Yeah.
So can the executive mobilize the militia of Virginia? You know?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
So on that note, we'll watch what's going on in the House tomorrow.
Yep.
I think we may actually be able to get it together for a podcast again, do two in a row next week, but we'll see.
Hey, hope springs eternal.
Yeah.
All right.
That'll be the Friday before class starts. So with that, as always, lots of content, data. You know, we made indirect reference to some of those Democratic numbers. You can find that at our website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts here at UT Austin, getting ready for another semester. Thanks to Josh for being here, and we'll be back soon, maybe even next week, with another Second Reading Podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.